Hello.
In my last lecture, I talked about the development of the state in the Valley of Mexico at the great site of Teotihuacan. I want to just emphasize a number of characteristics, just recall a number of characteristics and points that we need to keep in mind as we move to other parts of Mesoamerica. The first is that at Teotihuacan, then, we have what appears to be a single urban center and a single population center and a single political center that's dominating a significant region, certainly dominating the Valley of Mexico itself, but also able to exert influence in some way over significant distances beyond that, possibly into the Maya lowlands as much as 600 miles away. So a unitary territorial state. Second, the fascinating issue of the lack of development of rating systems in Teotihuacan. And this is particularly interesting because, as I noted last time, contemporary Maya populations did use rating. Elites at Teotihuacan would have been perfectly aware of how Maya elites were using this invention to display themselves. But as far as we know, this was never adopted by people in Teotihuacan. The implication is that while writing is a significant development, of course, it's not absolutely necessary for the running of a large territorial state. Third, and this is perhaps not so obvious, but extraordinarily important as well, as we move to the Maya territory, I spoke about the mapping of Teotihuacan, about the discovery of more than 2,000 of these complex apartment buildings on the site. Now, the reason that archaeologists can do this is because Teotihuacan is an open site. It's not covered by forest. The environment in the Valley of Mexico is quite open, only sparsely wooded. And so the distribution of architecture, of artifacts at Teotihuacan is more or less open on the surface of the ground to survey and to excavation. This is not going to be the case in the territory of the Maya people for the most part, which means that it's difficult for archaeologists to study some aspects of Maya society, for example, Maya urbanism, the distribution of non-elite sites, villages, hamlets, isolated farmsteads are harder to find in the regions occupied by the Maya. So the development of states and civilization among Maya populations in Mesoamerica provides a fascinating counterpoint to contemporary Teotihuacan. The area in which these political and cultural processes took place is not well defined at the boundaries, but the heartland of Maya civilization consists of, first, the Maya highlands along the Pacific coast in both Chiapas State in Mexico and in Guatemala, and the Maya lowlands, including the central Maya lowlands and the central and northern Yucatan Peninsula. Now, the Maya lowlands are a somewhat different kind of tropical forest than we've encountered to this point. Because with the Maya, what we see is populations occupying a relatively dry tropical forest that's subject to periodic drought, and that because of the geology, is relatively well drained. We're going to see that this is important because we can actually have situations in which Maya populations run out of water even though they are living in tropical forest. And this places a premium on water control. So this area occupied by the Maya encompasses parts of the modern nations of Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. However, cultural contacts and influences extended farther afield than that. We've already noted connections between Maya communities and Teotihuacan to the northwest. While trade and cultural relations certainly existed between the Maya and populations in modern Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama, the extent of Maya influences on these Central American societies continues to be debated. And indeed, we can imagine such contacts running into all of the neighboring areas to those occupied by the Maya themselves. As more archaeology gets done in Central America and in other surrounding regions, the areas through which such contacts existed between the Maya and their neighbors, those areas continue to be expanded. We know rather less about the development of agriculture in Maya territory than in highland Mesoamerica, in part, as I noted, because of the challenges of archaeological research in tropical forest. In this case, primarily problems with just finding archaeological sites under heavy forest cover. We can find large cities, but small settlements without monumental architecture that sort of pokes up out of the forest cover are much more difficult to locate. A few lectures ago, I mentioned, however, the site of San Andres on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. Pollen evidence from San Andres suggests that corn may have been cultivated there by 5000 BC and potentially manioc some centuries later. These crops, along with other staples, would form the basis of Mayan agriculture. In the 4th millennium BC, these two crops, corn and manioc, were being planted in what's now northern Belize. But the communities making use of them were still hunting extensively. And there's some question about how permanent their settlements were. So we're now seeming to be thinking about a gradual transition from hunting and gathering to full-scale agriculture, with perhaps these populations in Belize occupying an intermediate stage. And it really does not seem that people in the Maya lowlands were fully committed to agricultural ways of life until the late 2nd millennium BC. If we think about the late 2nd millennium BC, this is already a time at which populations in Veracruz, for example, in which Olmec populations are beginning the construction of those striking, extraordinary sites, ceremonial centers, first at San Lorenzo and then at La Venta. Perhaps the most important site for interpretations of these early farming communities in Maya territory has been Cuelo in what's now Belize. The earliest archaeological levels at Cuelo date to about 1200 BC, generally contemporary with the initial occupations at San Lorenzo. And the site was occupied more or less continuously until AD 1000. So it was occupied for a very long period of time, over 2000 years. Similar sites are found in north-central Guatemala as well, at places like Nacpe, Saibal, and Altar de Sacrificios. Farmers were probably settling in the highlands of Guatemala at about the same time. Now, these are all very, very small-scale communities. It's unlikely that any of these early farming villages at about 1200 BC would have been occupied by more than a few hundred people. There's no archaeological evidence for great differences in wealth or in social hierarchy on these sites at this time, although in later periods, that would change. In all of these cases, it seems that the period between about 1200 BC and 600 BC was one of relatively slow colonization of the Maya lowlands by pioneering farmers, with a gradual expansion of the land under cultivation. This is perfectly easy to comprehend when we think of the challenges of clearing tropical forest environments, developing productive farming systems that will work in tropical forest environments. Of these early farming sites, then, the Guatemalan sites, at least, had some connections with contemporary Olmec centers, with, for example, jade axes and other artifacts that probably came from La Venta, excavated at Ceibal. The question then becomes, of course, the question that then archaeologists ask ourselves, why were they being obtained? Why were these populations on small Guatemalan farming sites in what's now Maya territory trading to places like La Venta for what are actually prestige items? We have to ask ourselves, what does this exchange imply in terms of elite display? And as well, and very importantly, what other ideas were being introduced into Maya territory along with these jade axes? What kind of ideas about society and the cosmos and religion and hierarchy were these Maya communities being exposed to at the same time? There's an extraordinary acceleration in the pace of cultural change in the Maya area by the middle of the first millennium BC. So there's this phase of generally slow colonization and expansion of populations between perhaps 1200 BC and 600 BC, but then the pace of change picks up. It accelerates in the middle of the first millennium BC. And this involves a number of different factors. In the middle of the first millennium BC, both the number and the sizes of settlements in the Maya highlands and in the lowlands increase, as the population of the region seems to expand significantly. So we're getting population increase. Perhaps at this point, Maya farmers have solved some of the challenges of living in these somewhat difficult dry tropical forest environments, of water control, of planting, of developing a productive agricultural system. There's much more evidence by the middle of the first millennium BC for interchange and trade between communities in the region and beyond as well. By this time, these are no longer small, isolated frontier villages, if indeed they ever were. This may, in part, be accounted for by an increased demand for products originating in Maya territory. And this could include, for example, products like salt and honey. So a demand for these products from communities elsewhere in Mesoamerica. And equally as important, by the need for exotic and prestigious imports by members of developing local Maya elites. There's much more evidence for ceremonial activity on sites in the Maya region at this time. It's almost certain that such activity had been going on in earlier periods, but after about 600 BC, it is much more visibly represented in architecture and, in particular, types of artifacts. At the Guatemalan site of Nacbé, already mentioned, substantial earth and stone platforms, on average 2 to 3 meters or 6 to 10 feet high, were built between 800 and 600 BC. with small pyramids appearing shortly thereafter. Buildings seem to have been placed on top of these platforms, but they were made of wood and other organic materials, and they've more or less disappeared. Their functions are thus more or less unknown for these early periods. In later times, such buildings would have been made of stone, and in some cases they've been preserved until the present. When they do exist, they seem to have had multiple functions, probably as both habitations for members of community elites, and also as sites for ceremonial activities. And it's likely that the now vanished buildings on top of platforms and pyramids at Nak Bay performed more or less the same functions. There is other evidence that some people at Nak Bay were gaining more power and authority than others. Exotic objects like marine shells and jade were being imported into the community. And some children seem to have had their skulls deformed through binding in infancy in ways that we later associate with Maya elites. And we've already noted this practice in Oaxaca, for example. I talked about this in an earlier lecture. The recovery of stela fragments from Nak Bay provides a very striking illustration of developing concepts of elite rule in the Maya lowlands. One of these carved, freestanding stone panels shows a pair of figures probably representing the hero twins, who later play a ceremonial role, and a very important ceremonial role, as deified ancestors of Mayan ruling lineages. However, perhaps the most extraordinary manifestation of these cultural and political processes was not at Nak Bay, but at the site of El Mirador, only 13 kilometers or about 8 miles away. A ceremonial causeway called a Sakbe, which represented cosmological and political relations between different Maya centers, connected the two sites of Nak Bay and El Mirador. A number of other Sakbe radiate out from El Mirador and probably connect the site to other Maya centers. El Mirador is a spectacular site. It covers a total area of about 9,000 acres, and the remains of over 200 ceremonial structures, platforms, pyramids, open plazas, and other buildings had been found on this site of El Mirador. The site is overwhelmingly larger than any of its neighbors. And in fact, there's a good chance that Nak Bay's decline during the late first millennium BC probably coincides with competition from El Mirador. And indeed, one could see only 8 miles away approximately to have this gigantic site, to be in competition in a sense with this gigantic site situated that close. It's easy to see why Nak Bay may have lost that particular struggle. The largest structures on the El Mirador site are gigantic earth and stone platforms, upon each of which sits a series of three pyramids. On the so-called Tigre complex, the top three pyramids themselves sit on an enormous pyramid, which in turn sits on a platform. It's an amazing structure in its size and complexity. In total, the El Tigre complex is larger than the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan, and it was probably completed at least a century earlier. It and the other such complexes of monumental architecture at El Mirador, as well as the combination of masonry, platforms, and pyramids at contemporary sites like Lamanai in Belize, which dates to the period between about 500 BC and AD 100, are larger than any of the later and far more famous Maya architectural features. So in this early expression of monumental architecture in Maya territory, we see something that, at least in size and scale, would never be equaled in the area again. There has been some excavation done in residential areas around the ceremonial center of El Mirador. But at this point, archaeologists do not have a good sense of the total residential area or the population of the site. By analogy with later Maya centers, it seems unlikely that fewer than 100,000 people lived there at its height. Of course, this is smaller than Teotihuacan, but it's still an extremely substantial population. As I said, we're judging this primarily by analogy with later Maya sites. As on the Olmec sites, this uncertainty is in part due to the challenges of archaeological survey and excavation in a tropical forest environment. Much of the site is buried in undergrowth. Lack of firm population estimates, or of a good idea of the site, a good map of the site beyond the ceremonial center, makes it very difficult for us to understand the dynamics of El Mirador's rise and dominance over a large part of the Maya lowlands at the end of the first millennium BC. The iconography, the artwork of the site, generally links El Mirador and related sites of the same period with later and better known Maya political systems. And it seems reasonable to think of El Mirador as an early Mayan site, not merely in geographical terms, but also spatially and culturally, and the center of a significant state. However, it's really quite difficult to derive any sense of the extent or the workings, the internal political workings of that state, in part because, unlike the later Mayan cases, we don't have very many data that allow us to put El Mirador in regional context. It seems to have controlled a fairly large area, but we don't know the exact extent of that area. We don't know what its relations were to other contemporary centers, as, for example, Lamanai. What were its competitors like? And very importantly, I have to note that unlike later periods in the same region, no writing has been deciphered from the site of El Mirador to this point. In part because of these challenges, we still have difficulty accounting for the social and political transformation of this region at about 500 BC, and for the dynamics through which the state at El Mirador developed. We know little, for example, about the balance of external, perhaps Olmec, and internal factors that influenced its ascendancy. This ascendancy is not likely to have been peaceful. There seems to be a general movement of communities into more defensible locations during the late first millennium BC, and mass burials, possibly of sacrificed warriors, are found on a number of Belizean and Guatemalan sites. Similar processes were going on to the south in the highlands of Guatemala and Mexico at the same period. Sites like Camalhoyo and Takalik Abaj seem to have developed more or less in tandem with sites in the Maya lowlands. But there's no reason to think that they owed their inspiration in any sense to places like El Mirador. Rather, it seems more likely that urban centers in the Maya highlands and lowlands developed during this period within a web of political and economic relations, cooperating with one another, certainly through trade, and sometimes politically and perhaps even militarily, while competing at other times. And an analogy here might be the Uruk city-states of southern Mesopotamia in the late 4th millennium BC. By the end of the 1st millennium BC in the Maya region, trading relations certainly encompassed a whole variety of staple and prestige items in different areas. The sorts of goods that were being moved around would include salt, corn, manioc, cacao, dried fish, honey, obsidian, jade, and other semi-precious stones, marine shell, feathers, and many kinds of manufactured goods like ceramics and textiles. Particularly the highland centers seem to have engaged in long-distance exchange systems with attendant political relations. Thus, Caminalhuyu shows very significant evidence of influence from Teotihuacan. While a large number of artifacts deriving from Olmec culture have been found at Takalik Abaj. In conjunction with processes of agricultural intensification, including the introduction of irrigation systems and other water control mechanisms, as well as terracing systems, these economic developments, these developments in trading relationships, would provide both sustenance for large populations of commoners, and the material display that their rulers would use to justify their control over Maya states. El Mirador itself collapsed in the 3rd century AD, and this seems to have been a period of wider disruption in the region. One thing I'll note is that this also seems to have been a period of disruption, politically at least, at Teotihuacan. It's unclear whether this collapse at El Mirador was due to environmental or political factors or some combination of the two. And it's striking to note that people know so little about this enormous site. But this collapse of El Mirador and the disruptions that went along with it would open the way for the dominance of the great Maya city-states of the later 1st millennium AD. We're going to examine the development and the characteristics of these states in the following lectures. Thank you.